Today, the imprisonment of Alexei Navalny.
It has to be one of the grandest courtrooms that I've been in. A lot of these are very simple places, but this is the Moscow City Court.
Last week, The Guardian's Moscow correspondent Andrew Roth watched history being made.
It's this oak-paneled room, and then just behind the judge's bench, a giant scales of justice to kind of impart on everybody in the room that this is where justice takes place. And to the left, there's a big glass cell, and it's called the aquarium. And that's where the defendant, in this case, Alexei Navalny, is led into.
Alexei Navalny, the leader of Russia's opposition, had just made a dramatic return to Russia from Germany, where he had been treated for Novichok poisoning after a suspected assassination attempt. Now, he was facing a prison sentence.
He really used his time in court to deliver, as he often does in these cases, a major political speech, and in this case, a call to arms. And he basically delivers this 16-minute attack on Vladimir Putin and on the system that he's created in Russia. And he directly accuses Vladimir Putin of masterminding the attack against him last August, the use of a Novichok poison to try to kill him.
He says that the fact that he survived is the reason that Vladimir Putin is so angry at him right now. And he says one other thing. He says that what's at stake here isn't really just his arrest, but that they're trying to put one person in prison in order to scare millions of his supporters off the streets.
Hanging in the balance wasn't just the fate of one man, but of an entire opposition movement.
The seconds after the decision was delivered by the judge, when he drew a heart on the glass casing of the cell that he was in, I was standing behind his wife, Yulia, and you could see that she was tearing up and she kind of pulled off her mask and waved to him to say goodbye and I don't know when I'll see you soon, to shrug as if what else can you kind of expect from the decision. And he yells out across the courtroom, he says, "Don't be sad, everything's going to be okay. Goodbye."
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how Vladimir Putin put his biggest opponent behind bars and what it means for Russia. Andrew Roth, you're The Guardian's Moscow correspondent and you've been following this story for a long time. The last point that Alexei Navalny dominated global headlines was in August last year when he was poisoned on an internal Russian flight with the nerve agent Novichok and taken to Germany for medical treatment.
August 20th. On a flight to Moscow, a passenger captures the awful wails of Alexei Navalny.
What happened to him there?
At that point, it wasn't quite clear if he was going to live or if he was going to die. When he arrives in Germany, he's brought comatose to the Charité Clinic, which is this very well-known Berlin clinic that's treated other Russians who have also been mysteriously poisoned or fallen mysteriously ill. And he came out of the coma after a few weeks, and then he began his recovery. And he says basically that he had to learn how to walk again, that he had to learn how to pick things up again, learning to speak again, learning to think again, and that all of this took an immense amount of energy. From when he wakes up and when he starts to see his family, it quickly becomes clear that he wants to continue the political life that he's been running for the past 10 years.
Navalny has always said that Putin was behind this, and Russia, of course, denied that. But what have we found out in recent months about how he was poisoned?
What we found out via a fairly sensational investigation from Bellingcat, which is an online group of journalists and investigators who use open source information, and from Navalny himself too, is that for years Navalny was shadowed by a group of FSB agents. Those are people who work for Russia's main intelligence agency, and that they had been following him right up until the point when he fell extremely sick on that flight. And the second thing that we found out is that these people have very close connections to a chemical weapons laboratory in Russia that is tied to the development of the Novichok poisons that were used in the UK in 2018, and according to doctors in Berlin, were used to poison Navalny in 2020. And so based on that, Navalny was able to say fairly directly that, I know that it's Vladimir Putin who ordered the FSB to poison me in August of this year.
And you say Navalny himself was involved in investigating this. How did he go about doing that?
This was at the end of a big investigation when they had used flight data and geolocation data to basically identify the different FSB agents, the individuals who had likely poisoned him. And so the last thing that they did before they published this investigation is Navalny basically said, I would like a chance to try to make them confess to the fact that they poisoned me. And so as they tell it, Navalny basically went down the list of the FSB agents that they had identified, identifying himself and saying, did you try to poison me? And each one said, no, I didn't. Or they hung up the phone. You know, obviously, what would you do in that case? You know, you get off the call as quickly as possible. But what they do is they get to the last man on the list. And before Navalny calls him up, he decides that he's going to impersonate the aide of a senior Russian official.
Konstantin.
And so basically call him up as though your boss calls you early in the morning, 6 a.m., and says, what happened with this Navalny investigation? How did you cock this one up so badly? Hoping that he would be able to pressure him and basically bully him into giving up all the information about the investigation. And surprisingly, amazingly, sensationally, that is exactly what happened. Shortly after the actual investigation was released, and if you felt like your jaw couldn't hit the floor any harder, it was hearing one of them on the phone actually saying, if it hadn't been for the work of the medics on the plane and on the ground and how quickly the pilots got into the hospital, he probably wouldn't have survived. It wasn't our fault. Basically admitting that if there was any kind of evidence about the poisoning left, physical evidence, where the poison might still be, it's probably located in the inseam of his underpants.
No. What was it doing there?
Well, there are different theories about what it's doing there, but what appears to be the case is that it was the actual underpants that were poisoned because it was seen as a good medium to get the poison which needs to physically touch the person into the body. And so what's closer to your skin than your underpants? And so when Navalny comes up in court last week and he talks about Putin, he basically makes fun of him and pans him and says, there's been Yaroslav the Wise, and Putin will go down in history as Putin the underpants poisoner.
I mean, it's a great line.
From the very beginning, sometimes you have to pinch yourself to realize that this is all true.
And after all of this, Navalny decided to return to Russia. Why?
I guess the first thing we should start with is that Alexei Navalny is never really a person who was looking to emigrate. He always seemed like he was willing to go to prison for the cause that he was working for. The second thing I think to keep in mind is that he realized that if he was forced into exile, which is really what the Kremlin wanted, I think at that point you could see it from the attempts to scare him away from coming back, he would basically undermine his own political movement. It's very difficult to be an opposition member from abroad because it looks hypocritical. It looks like you're scared of being in your own country. He knew that he had to come back to Russia.
And he did come back to the country a couple of weeks ago. You were at the airport when he arrived. What was it like? And what happened when he returned?
Russia does political spectacle in a way that I think that few other countries can do it, although the US has challenged that in recent years. The sense that all the activists are coming to the airport, the riot police are coming to the airport, the counter-demonstrators are coming to the airport, you know, all the journalists are coming to the airport. This sense that just the circus comes to the airport. Yeah. I would say maybe 1,000 people or more kind of crowd into this arrivals hall at Vnukovo Airport, which is on the outskirts of Moscow. And nobody's quite clear about what exactly is going to happen that day. And so then I guess what everybody should have expected happened, which is that they diverted his plane to a completely different airport. And it was all for naught.
Do you remember the moment when you found out that was happening?
Yes. Everybody suddenly starts to look up at the big board and all the flights coming in on time. And then there's one flight, Berlin, that says delayed. And then says diverted to Sheremetyevo Airport, which is maybe an hour away. And I just remember the push of journalists towards that. And you see some running for the door. And I just remember seeing two riot policemen with these massive helmets just start laughing at this moment because they just, I doubt they knew what was going to happen, but they loved the fact that it did.
Oh my God, it just sounds like chaos. So his plane gets diverted to an airport where nobody is. What happened next?
So the plane lands, and Navalny does make it off the plane with his wife, Yulia. He's also with members of his team. And right before passport control, which is in this big hall, he stops everybody and gives a kind of impromptu press conference, where he basically stands up and says, "I'm not afraid, and you shouldn't be afraid either." Which has kind of become an impromptu and unofficial, I guess, mantra of this return. And then he walks off towards passport control. And as soon as he gets to the window, he's met by about 8 police officers. And it becomes very clear that they're going to arrest him and take him away. And so he turns back, he gives his wife Yulia a peck on the cheek, and then he heads off with them. And he isn't seen anymore that evening.
What was the basis for them arresting him?
The basis for them arresting him is a parole violation for a sentence he received in 2014. He had served most of this sentence, this parole, but before it ended, he was poisoned and he went to Germany. And after that, the prisons argued that he had failed to report in after he had come out of his coma. And we found a bunch of other violations.
So Navalny knew when he returned to Russia that he'd immediately be in a standoff with the government. Was this all part of a strategy for him, do you think?
This decision to come back to the country and be arrested, willingly sacrificing yourself and putting yourself into this situation, is kind of a singular act. It's really historic and unusual among even Russian opposition figures. And so it's unclear if there was a full strategy at the beginning, but at the very least, he felt like this was a challenge that he couldn't step away from. And so before he came back, they did plan for what they were going to do once he was imprisoned. And the thing that they did is that they began one big investigation into the biggest politician in the country, Vladimir Putin.
What did that investigation uncover?
This is an investigation into, I guess, what you have to call a palace in southern Russia overlooking the Black Sea that people always believed, since it was identified in 2010, had been built for Vladimir Putin's personal use.
Привет, это Навальный. И это расследование мы придумали еще когда я находился в реанимации.
And this investigation managed to uncover a lot of the background of how Putin's friends and state companies invested £1 billion in order to kind of build this massive palace. I mean, that just has everything from gardens to a secret tunnel that goes out to the sea, which apparently has a tasting room that you can look over these kind of sea views, to what's been called an aqua disco.
An aqua disco?
An aqua disco, yeah, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a disco that basically gives you the sense of dancing in a kind of aquatic setting. And it turns out that there's not one of them, but two.
And what impact did this investigation have in Russia?
Online, I mean, this is a bombshell investigation. The easiest way that we know to judge that is just based on the number of YouTube views it has, which is 100 million, which is far more than any other investigation they've done. The aqua disco becomes a meme. The presidential press secretary is forced to deny the fact that it exists. And this is probably the closest that this scandal has gotten to the mainstream. The knowledge that it was probably built for Putin. And in the end, one of his close friends, and a very wealthy person in his own right, Arkady Rotenberg, is forced to take it onto himself and say, "This is my palace." So in the end, it is something of a scandal for the government. I think that the other thing it does, though, is it shows that even though Alexei Navalny is in prison, he manages to just put out this devastating investigation into Vladimir Putin himself. That was the moment, I think, when people realized that even in prison, he could be very dangerous to Vladimir Putin. And he had really thought through what was going to happen next. And what happens pretty shortly after the release of this investigation is that his team calls for new demonstrations against Vladimir Putin.
How did Navalny's supporters respond to these calls to action?
The first rally that happens after this investigation is released is on the 23rd of January, and nobody really knows what to expect. It's been a long time since we've really seen the kind of big, sustained, powerful protest come out onto the streets. And it's kind of in this sense of not knowing what's going to happen next that you come out onto Pushkinskaya Square, and tens of thousands of people come out to protest against Vladimir Putin and for Alexei Navalny to be released. They're not the largest protest that Russia's seen ever. I was here in 2011 when you had 100,000 people come out onto Bolotnaya Square, and that was a truly massive protest. But for a protest where everybody came out and was facing jail, the fact that an estimated 40,000 people came out onto the streets, it created absolute gridlock. People are chanting. The police are basically at the front arresting people. You can barely move, basically, inside of this crowd.
And you were there at those protests in Moscow. What was it like reporting on it?
I've been to a lot of protests at this point, and they all start to kind of blend together. But there are a few times that you come out and you really are surprised by the number of people who show up, by the determination of the people who show up, even if they might be arrested. And I think the last thing was actually by the willingness of some of the protesters to fight back, which is something that you don't often see. And this is something that repeated itself in other cities across the country, cities as far away as Vladivostok in the Far East, even further east. I mean, you had some kind of presence, and I think it was a very important demonstrative moment, and you could feel that. One thing that really felt different in the last couple of protests is you've seen a much younger crowd. Navalny is releasing these investigations online. He's quite an effective communicator on the internet. And that's kind of really brought in high school students and college students. And so there was this one young girl who teaches English. She's an influencer on Instagram.
I'm American.
And she basically has this fun video where she teaches her supporters, if they are arrested or detained at a rally, how to pretend that they're an American.
I left my passport at the hotel.
Who just was happening to kind of walk through the protest and came out at the wrong time.
I'm gonna call my lawyer.
Ingenious. And was there anyone at the protest that you spoke to, Andrew, that left a particular impression on you?
There was one woman, Yulia, who was 45 years old, and she had come out with her son, Nikolai, who was 18. And I asked her if this was her first protest and why she came out. And she was like, actually, I used to protest, but I stopped for years. I'd really kind of lost heart. I didn't understand what it was for. And she remembered in 2015 when this opposition politician named Boris Nemtsov was shot and killed near the Kremlin. And she had just fallen into kind of a funk, I think, after that. She said that after the poisoning of Navalny, she said, I'd really just decided enough was enough. I'm not even totally a supporter of his. I don't agree with all of his politics. Navalny has a kind of history as a nationalist politician and not as much as a liberal politician like many of the opposition are. So she was like, I don't really support him in that sense, but it just felt like what they did to him was the last drop. I just felt like I had to come out today. And I had to have my son with me to see that.
So while Navalny's arrest triggered these protests, as Yulia said to you, this is about more than him. What else drove people to demonstrate?
I think one is, it's not a like of Navalny, but a dislike of Vladimir Putin. I think that some people are motivated strongly by disliking the way that Russia has changed in the last 20 years, particularly from the 90s, which had been a difficult period, but some say a freer period than we're in right now. And I think that's objectively clear. I think that there are a lot of other people who are angered by corruption. And I think that a lot of people just feel like Russia has been getting poorer in the last 10 years, and maybe that life has gotten worse to a certain degree. You know, there are places like Moscow in the center where you can see new construction, but a lot of parts of the country are really hurting. And I think financially, a lot of people are hurting. And it all kind of mixes up. But when you have this kind of spark, like Alexei Navalny, and the case of what happened to him, it sort of creates a reason for people to come out and to air those grievances.
Andrew, those huge protests continued into last week. 5,000 people were detained from demonstrations that took place across 11 time zones. And then last Tuesday, after that dramatic courtroom scene you told us about, Navalny was given his verdict. What sentence did he receive?
Navalny was sentenced to 3 years and 6 months in prison. He'd already served some of that under house arrest. So he will go to a prison colony for 2 years and 8 months. But they are at this point considering further charges against him. And some think that it may be far longer before he's allowed out.
And what kind of prison is he going to? What will it be like?
We don't actually know where he's going to be going next. What we know is that it's going to be somewhere in central Russia. It'll be remote. And based on where people usually go, I mean, this is a prison colony, so it's more than just a single prison building. We're talking about barracks where the prisoners live. In the past, tuberculosis has been a major problem. These other kind of diseases you don't often think about, just the cold and damp, difficult camp life.
You've talked about Navalny's wife, Yulia, being there in court with him. What will this verdict mean for her and for their two children?
So it was clear before the verdicts came down that they had thought about that because the children are abroad. And for Yulia, it's clear, I think, to me that she understood this decision would mean that she was isolated in Moscow, but that she wasn't going to leave the country, that she would continue to support him from here. But that it's sort of a very lonely and difficult road that she has to face.
How was Navalny's sentencing received across Russia?
Shortly after the sentence came down, his team called for people to come down to a very central square called Manezhnaya and begin to protest. This is something that the Kremlin had anticipated. Driving around Moscow that day was like a fortress. Really, every street felt like it had been blocked off. These kind of riot police in helmets that are informally called the cosmonauts. And we saw these very violent, brutal scenes. When you see something like 1,200 arrests at a protest, I mean, that's already a lot, but to have it happen in 1 or 2 hours at night really showed the degree of the crackdown.
Coming up, Alexei Navalny's behind bars, but is he still a threat to Vladimir Putin? Andrew, Vladimir Putin has got Navalny behind bars, but he presumably would have preferred him dead. And there have been these huge protests. Will this have rattled him at all?
Vladimir Putin had not wanted to put Navalny behind bars, it was clear, because they were worried about him becoming this kind of political martyr. But the Kremlin has made really clear that they no longer care about the international condemnation and that they no longer care about the possibility of protests taking place in Moscow or in other cities across Russia. It's a real turning point for how Russia treats the opposition. And it does feel a little bit like having done this now, having taken this most, you know, sensational step, they might not be afraid to crack down far harder on anybody else who considers stepping out of line, holding a protest, or doing anything similar to that. And it's clear that this is a new era that we're walking into.
With Navalny in prison, what happens to the protest movement in Russia now? Can it continue without him?
That's a really good question, and that's sort of the million-dollar question right now. By going to prison, I mean, Navalny becomes a sort of political martyr, and I think it does increase his profile quite importantly. But there are major questions about who's going to run this massive online infrastructure that they have put together. You could see how chaotic the protests were already when most of his senior aides had been arrested and put away because there was nobody on the ground who was really able to run the protests. This summer, there was a very big protest movement in Belarus that began and was kind of run online on the social network Telegram, where kind of an anonymous account would send out instructions that we're going to meet here this week. It's not clear if that kind of model could work for Russia. So I think that the next months are going to be a turning point for this whole organization that Navalny has built. This investigations group, his online television group, this media group, all of it is going to have to figure out what to do without Alexei Navalny.
He spoke earlier, Andrew, about how young some of the protesters at these demonstrations are. Do you think this might make a difference to what happens to the movement in the next few years?
I think it's important for there to be young people in the group, and I think that that's a group that the Kremlin is very worried about losing. They want to make Vladimir Putin cool, but it's really important for the protest movement to reach Russians of all ages and maybe move a little bit beyond the internet, because I think that there's a feeling that it's also a kind of weakness of the protest that it can be portrayed as a kind of youth action. You know, Navalny is getting these young people to come out to protest for him, and there's a worry that if it looks too young, then it won't be respected by older Russians.
Finally, do you think that Alexei Navalny will become a significant part of Russia's history?
I still think that that decision to come back to the country when he knew that he was being forced out, in and of itself, is just one of the most consequential decisions that I've seen and principal decisions that I've seen since I started working here as a journalist in 2011. I think at least for this period of Vladimir Putin's rule, which has been going on 21 years now. Putting him in prison was definitely one of these era-defining moments that's going to be very important for the future. You know, in 2005, there was a criminal case against an oligarch named Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who had challenged Putin. And that was seen as a message to the oligarchs that you can't challenge Putin, you have to come in line. And this feels like probably the most significant decision since then, and maybe more significant. We really stepped from maybe an imitation democracy, a place that imitates having a kind of opposition that isn't controlled by the Kremlin, to something much darker.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Andrew Roth. Read all of his reporting and keep up with the ongoing fallout from Navalny's imprisonment at theguardian.com. And do go back and listen to an episode we made last year about his poisoning with Luke Harding called The Poisoning of Alexei Navalny. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef and exec'd by Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Axel Kakoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.